From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It looks like the United States has hit a COVID-19 plateau, with more than 40,000 people hospitalized and more than 400 deaths a day consistently over the past month. Now, this is according to the latest data. Health experts say this is a dramatic improvement over what we saw this past winter, when there were four times as many hospitalizations and nearly six times as many deaths at the peak of the first Omicron wave. And this has many health professionals wondering what's next. Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, is joining us live to talk more about that. And remember, if you have a question about COVID and monkeypox, because we will also be talking about that today with Dr. Pate, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Welcome, Dr. Pate.
Hi, Gemma.
Okay, so Dr. Pate, one big question that a lot of health experts have is why we see these surges, right? And then basically, it's because COVID is still a mystery to us in many ways, even though we're 2.5 years into this pandemic.
Well said. You know, certainly people have suggested that it's because of us quote unquote wall of immunity. I have a lot of trouble accepting that as the explanation. And this isn't the first time we've seen this behavior. You may recall more than a year ago, a year and a half ago, I was very worried that we were going to have a big alpha surge here in Idaho because we were seeing it around us. And in fact, Oregon and Washington states had big surges with alpha. We didn't. I have absolutely no explanation for why that didn't happen. And nobody else has a good explanation either. So, yeah, there's still, as you said, very much about this virus that we don't understand.
And with that said, Dr. Pate, I mean, that's part of it, right? Is that, there's this idea that, okay, we're stabilizing with this plateau. But yet, when you're talking about 400,000 hospitalizations a day across the country, 40,000 rather people hospitalized, that's still a lot of people.
Well, it is. And, you know, we're having, I think 400, 500 deaths, on average, you know, so it obviously is more than I would like. A lot of people are either numb to the numbers or they look at it, well, but it's a lot less than what it was, which that's true. Or they look at it, yeah, but I don't have anybody in my family or I don't know somebody that's being impacted, so it's not a big deal. So, you know, a lot of this is that we do just kind of become accepting that, you know, in exchange for our normal routines is that there are a certain number of people that are going to get very, very sick and die in this country. And we can certainly debate whether that's the proper attitude. But I do think that the most concerning thing is that we should not get lulled into complacency about this virus.
Right. And with that said, Dr. Pate, can we talk about a new test that researchers at MIT, so the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, have created, that this might predict how much immunity a person has to COVID?
Yeah, you know, it's very exciting. And you'll remember a few months ago, we talked about another test that was developed kind of looking at the other side of the immune system called the cellular immune response. Mm-hmm. I think all of this is great. I think we need to come up with more and more sophisticated testing options that can give us meaningful information. Now, I haven't seen the published data, and I'm not sure it has been published yet on this test. The researchers say that it correlates very well to the level of neutralizing antibodies. I'm not sure how they distinguish between neutralizing and binding antibodies. So that would be a question I have for them. But I, you know, take them at their word, and I'll look for the evidence before the test becomes available, that it it has correlated well with neutralizing antibodies, which would be helpful. Two problems. One is we still don't know the correlates of immune protection. So what that is, that's a fancy phrase for meaning we know neutralizing antibodies are important, but we don't know if it's the only thing that's important, and we don't know how much of those neutralizing antibodies you need. Obviously, more is better, but I am not sure how we would tell someone that has level A that, oh yeah, that's good and going to protect you from getting infected. So, you know, more to come, but I do think each one of these steps is getting us closer to a point where we really can assess this risk much, much better. Of course, another question will be, when these tests come out, affordability, because if, you know, you would probably have to do this test on a serial basis, and especially, you know, there would be some question when we have a new variant come out, and we're not sure if the previous neutralizing antibodies are as effective, but nevertheless, it's a positive step. I wouldn't say this is now the miracle cure to our situation, but it's certainly an important step.
Well, and we should say, I mean, the test that they've come up with at MIT is a, you have to do like a prick, like a blood prick on your finger. I can see a lot of people not wanting to do that. With that said, though, what I do think is interesting about it is that, you know, if this were, because it's, you know, it's the this is new, is that if it did work, I mean, it could tell someone like, all right, maybe you're at this level of immunity. So if levels are high, you should mask or you should do X or Z, whatever that may look like in order to protect yourself.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's exciting. It's and I don't know. I'll wait to see the evidence, whether it really can tell that at a certain level, you can feel protected. On the other hand, it may be just helpful in that if it's low, you know, hey, don't be assuming that you're well protected and probably ought to be looking at whether you need a booster. So we're going to have to see from the studies what exact question can it answer if we have that test, because I don't want to say or suggest to somebody that if you have neutralizing antibodies, then you're absolutely protected. It's clear neutralizing antibodies are very important, and it's clear that the more the better, but I don't know, you know, what the degrees of protection are relative to various levels of those neutralizing antibodies. But I do think we're honing in on that and we're moving in the right direction. So that's very welcome.
So Dr. Pate, we've heard a lot recently about people getting rebound COVID symptoms, in particular if they take Paxlovid. It's been in the news because this is what happened to President Biden recently. There is a preprint study, so for folks want to know what that is, that means it hasn't been published in a peer-reviewed journal yet. But what this preprint study found, Dr. Pate, is that around a third of people with COVID will experience a rebound of their symptoms, whether or not they even take Paxlovid.
Yeah, I think that was, it was certainly surprising to me. I think it's been surprising to most of the people that I've talked to. We do know that that can occur. I don't think we understand why very well. I think the biggest implication of this study and the Paxlovid rebound information is that all of this puts much more into question the wisdom of just having, you know, the reduction in isolation from the 10 days to the 5 days. And that if that high a percentage of people are rebounding, and our current guidelines that I see, you and I discussed some of the school guidelines last week. You know, one of those guidelines talks about your symptoms improving. Well, your symptoms improve, you test negative, but then you get the rebound. And by the limited evidence we have right now, you may be contagious again with the rebound. And so it does call into question the wisdom of keeping the isolation so short with a virus that behaves like this.
Once again, I think it just comes down to the fact that we still don't know all there is to know about COVID.
That sums it up. Gemma, you're right. That sums it up.
We had a listener who said that they found the COVID-19 vaccine called Novavax in Idaho at the Costco in Nampa. So have we seen this vaccine around Idaho much?
No, we haven't. This vaccine, Novavax, was just recently authorized by the FDA and given the go-ahead for distribution by the CDC. This is an important vaccine because, number one, for those people that have been holding out because they just don't like the new technology of the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, and they want something that's kind of more traditional, this is the vaccine for you. Also, it in the studies, it looked very like it performed very, very well. So this is an important addition to the offerings that we have. And it is a two-shot series. Another common question I get is, can I get that for my booster? No, you can't. You have to, it's only approved or authorized rather for a primary series. And it's only authorized for those over 18. But that just happened recently. They've had some production and manufacturing challenges, so it's not coming on the scene fast. But as of the end of the month, states could request allocations of the Novavax. And so we have started seeing early this month it showing up. It's hit or miss. Because it's not in large amounts. But yes, it is being distributed to the various states. I don't think there's a lot of it here in Idaho, but I am pleased to hear from this listener is starting to show up because I think it's an important alternative for those that particularly are you know, just uncomfortable with getting the mRNA vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Payton, Nancy writes in. She says her pregnant daughter tested positive for COVID, and so she wants to know, can she take any COVID treatments? Because their concern is that it would impact the unborn baby.
Well, yeah, it's a big concern because not only can certain of the treatments potentially affect the baby, because most of the studies haven't tested these drugs in women who are pregnant. They usually were excluded from the studies. But on the other hand, we have overwhelming evidence that COVID it can be very harmful, more harmful for the pregnant woman and the child. So you're caught in that situation where, you know, either option may be severe. We do have options that we believe are safe. They haven't been tested, but their use in other situations has been not problematic for pregnant women, and particularly relating to the monoclonal antibodies. So what I would suggest, I mean, I'm sure this person has already done it, but the important thing is to immediately get in touch with her obstetrician, because we need to make an assessment of, based on how far is she in her pregnancy, how sick is she, you know, what's going on. But the time is of the evidence, because some of these therapies that we can fairly safely use in pregnancy, they need to be done fairly quickly. So hopefully she's called her obstetrician. If not, do it today, right now.
And one more question about COVID. This comes from Kelly, and she says, with past strains of COVID, we've been led to believe they have not been as transmissible or symptomatic in children. Is this correct? Does that appear to be increasing with each version? And where do we sit with this current strain?
Well, yes, it is correct. We've been led to believe that, but no, that's not a correct fact. In fact, what we have seen is, and this was really her second question, is that indeed with each variant of concern, it appears that they are more transmissible. And until we get to Omicron, where we start throwing in the fact that now there's a fair degree of immune evasion. But really what seems to be the advantage for each of these subsequent variants of concern and how they seem to take over from the other previous variants is transmissibility. And that includes kids. We have seen a lot more transmission in children, especially this year compared to the first year. And it is true that it does appear early on, it appeared that really only about 79% early on in the very beginning of the pandemic of kids were asymptomatic. So the overwhelming majority. I don't have a good number now, but it appears that kids are more likely to get symptomatic. And what we have seen this year is more kids getting hospitalized. It's still a low number, but it's more than with previous variants prior to Omicron.
I want to switch gears now to monkeypox, because just last week, the U.S. Health and Human Services declared monkeypox a public health emergency here in the United States. And we have been getting a lot of questions from our listeners, especially about the vaccine and about how kids can get this virus. And as of yesterday, more than 9,400 people in the United States have been diagnosed with monkeypox, including 8 people here in Idaho. And 600,000 doses of the vaccine have gone out to states. But the head of the CDC says as many as 1.7 million people may be at high risk for contracting monkeypox. In fact, NPR is reporting that federal officials are stretching the supply of the vaccine as much as possible. So, Dr. Pate, we have gotten so many questions in regards to monkeypox. So before we get to the questions, and we briefly touched on this last week, and I think it's important that we talk about this again. And this is about, once again, I think what we are being led to believe about how monkeypox is contracted. Can we make it very clear that this is not a sexually transmitted disease? Yes, you can get it through sexual contact, but it is not the only way that this virus is spread.
Yes, this virus has multiple modes of transmission. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about this virus, because even though there have been outbreaks of this disease in Africa for decades, the United States, the CDC, and the World Health Organization have done essentially very little to investigate it and understand this virus. And I think that's a shame. And I think we're going to have to change our public health response. I think people were thinking, oh, well, it only affects people in Africa and it seems limited there, so what do we care? Which is a bit cold and insensitive, because I think obviously there's a lot of suffering in Africa that we should help with. But that aside, we have to understand that in this day and age, with the amount of international travel we have a day, the interconnectedness of business and pleasure travel and so forth, we have to take these serious wherever they occur. And had we responded to monkeypox over the past few decades, we would know a lot more about it. So what do we know? We know that something has changed in the transmission, because prior to May of this year, we really haven't identified quote unquote sexual transmission of monkeypox. By and large, monkeypox previous to May, it was contact, close contact, usually skin to skin contact with somebody who had these rash lesions on their body. And most of that household occurred, most of that transmission occurred within households. And so in Africa, if you look prior to May, in fact, significant percentage of people that got monkeypox were women and were kids, because it spread in households. Now, there is something different going on in this virus now. And we know it's been transmitting under the radar and accumulating mutations, because we haven't contained this. And so there are some differences. But to assume a wholesale change in how the virus is transmitted is a huge leap. That is unusual. It shouldn't be our presumption. And we made the same mistake with COVID. You'll remember back in March of 2020, even earlier, getting assurances from folks, public health agencies, that this was not transmitted as a respiratory virus. And of course, COVID is. So I think we're making some dangerous messaging by suggesting, as some have, that this is a sexually transmitted disease, because then people will conclude, well, if I'm not sexually active, or if I have, I'm monogamous, I have a single partner, then I'm not going to be at risk. And that is true, that their risk is greatly reduced if that's the case, but it is not zero, as we're seeing. We're seeing now more women with evidence of an infection, and we're seeing it in kids, as you mentioned, and even young kids. So this is concerning. The biggest way that you're going to, you know, the highest risk people are those people who are sexually active with multiple partners, and especially partners that they don't know. And so that certainly today is the biggest risk. And if you fit in that group, then you need to think about getting vaccinated, and you need to think about taking some precautions. However, and you can see from even these public health agencies that suggest this is sexually transmitted disease, the easiest way to realize that they don't even believe that is look at what their precautions are, and how they say that, for example, at the hospital, at the hospital, the people treating people with monkeypox need to be in PPE. Well, if you're not, if it's a sexually transmitted disease, why do you have to be in? I mean, because we're not having sex with the patients, for God's sakes. And the same thing, they say, well, you have to, if you're going to handle the samples, it has to be in a high bio security level. Well, if it's only sexually transmitted, why is that the case? So I think, yes, it can be transmitted in a number of different ways. The most common, what we're seeing today, but I suspect this is going to change, is that these sexual networks are transmitting it, probably because of the opportunity. When you have sex, there's usually the close skin-to-skin opportunity. And if you're interacting with lots of people and people you don't know, and even people from around the country or the world, you're gonna have great opportunities to spread this. I don't think that's ultimately the way that this is going to be transmitted, but right now it's close contact with people that is the biggest risk.
So Dr. Pate, a lot of people are in the process of sending their kids to college. In fact, this week, a lot of kids in Idaho are going off to college. One listener, Colleen, wrote in and she says, I'm sending my son to live in a college dorm. So what concern and safety should we be concerned with in communal living? They'll have shared laundry, they have roommates, they have shared shower facilities, et cetera.
Yeah, so every year when kids go off to college, there are some specific health risks that we have to worry about, because college students are very social, they tend to be together. Also, it's not uncommon for them to have a roommate or multiple roommates. And of course, that adds to the potential risk. One of those risks that is perennial is meningitis. So one thing you want to do is make sure you talk to your doctor and see if your child should get the meningococcal vaccine before they go off to college. With respect to where we are today, of course, two of the big concerns are going to be COVID and monkeypox. And certainly for COVID, the best thing you can do for your kids is to get them fully vaccinated. You also want to explore where they're going to be living, who are they going to be living with, because if they have a roommate, there needs to be a plan if the roommate gets sick, so that their child, it limits the exposure and the risk to them. With monkeypox, this becomes an even bigger issue. There's a far more risk of getting COVID than there is monkeypox, but you'll remember at the very beginning of COVID, we spent a lot of time talking about cleaning surfaces and so forth. And some people were spraying down their groceries and all kinds of things. What we found out is COVID actually doesn't transmit that way by touch very much. Now, that is completely different with monkeypox, even though, again, like we were talking about, there's multiple modes and not all modes are common modes of transmission. Monkeypox has been well documented to be able to be transmitted through things like the linens. If you have somebody who has monkeypox and has those lesions and they sleep, they're going to be on linens, and those linens can contain viable virus. So certainly things like shaking the sheets is not a good idea. That puts that virus up in the air where you can breathe it. You want to be very careful, even more careful about hand hygiene when you're dealing with that situation. But I think the big things, although there's much we could talk about, big things is let's have a common agreement among roommates that, number one, that you understand whatever risks you take are risks you're imposing on your roommates. So be respectful of that. And second, if you do become symptomatic, alert your roommate right away. There are things that should be considered. So for example, with monkeypox, it is transmissible to many animals, and we don't want this virus to get established in animal chains here. So if you have a pet, that pet should probably be placed outside the home somehow with friends, boarding with the vet, whatever, but you want to get that pet out of the house until your lesions are crusting over and falling off. Second is you need to have a plan with a roommate, because again, there's going to be a significant chance for transmission of the virus by just being in close contact. So if there's a possibility that somebody can be relocated, they consider that. If not, then there just needs to be a lot of precautions. You're certainly not going to want to mingle. You want that sick roommate to stay in their room. You want to be very careful about how things that they touch are going to be handled. So those are some of the considerations that need to be made.
So we have a lot of questions about the monkeypox vaccine, Dr. Pate. So we've had questions in regards to, is it available here in Idaho? Who can get the vaccine? Who should get the vaccine? How effective is it? So let's start with that first one. Is it available in Idaho?
It is, but in very low amounts. So what is happening is that vaccine, through some emergency declarations and actions on the part of the CDC and the FDA, do make this vaccine available when necessary. So there's two ways you can use the vaccine. One is what we call pre-exposure prophylaxis. That means that we're just going to vaccinate those people that are at the highest risk. Right now, what we've talked about, although I don't think this will be the case long term, as I said, but right now, the highest risk groups appear to be men, and particularly men who have sex with men, but people that have that are sex workers, or people that are in networks with multiple partners, those are going to be the highest risk people. Those people need to contact their doctor or the public health department about arranging to get vaccinated prophylactically, pre-exposure prophylaxis, as we call it. Then there is post-exposure prophylaxis. And what that means is that if you have been exposed in a way that has put you in close contact with somebody who now is demonstrated to have monkeypox, because monkeypox has a very long incubation period, it's been found that if we vaccinate those persons, especially within 4 days of that close contact, we have a good chance of being able to prevent the exposed person from getting infected. So that group does not have the same restrictions about that you know, men having sex with men and so forth. So mm-hmm. You may be a family member, you may be a caretaker, you may be something else, but that doesn't have those restrictions, but you just need to have had an established exposure. So that's what's available right now, just because we just don't have enough vaccine to vaccinate everybody that we'd like to.
Okay, so let's reiterate that point again, Dr. Pate. So who can get the vaccine?
Okay, if you have not been exposed, then but you just want to be protected, then right now it's high-risk individuals. So particularly men who have sex with men, if you're homosexual, bisexually, and you're sexually active, and especially if you have multiple partners, you're at the top of the list. There are some healthcare workers now, it's kind of being debated about which ones, but certainly if you work in the laboratory with the monkeypox virus, if you're on the team that would be treating these individuals, there is sometimes allowance being made to vaccinate those people as well. So that's pre-exposure prophylaxis. Otherwise, if you have been exposed and you know that this person had monkeypox and you were in very close contact with them, contact the public health department. They will establish whether that is the case, that you have close contact, and then you can get vaccine. And again, we try to do that within 4 days of having had that exposure to prevent you from getting monkeypox. But we can't even do it outside that. It may not prevent you from getting monkeypox, but if we do it within 14 days, generally you'll get a milder case of monkeypox.
And then how effective is the vaccine?
We don't know for sure. And the reason is because of what I said before, we never took the opportunity to really study this when we had these outbreaks in Africa. In fact, we didn't even provide them with vaccine, which is a real shame. So we don't know for sure. As you know, with the COVID, the way that we have established the vaccine efficacy is that we've vaccinated people and then we look at what are the rates of people still getting COVID or getting severely ill and so on. We just don't have that data. So we use the next best, which is some animal studies and so forth. We believe that the vaccine efficacy for the monkeypox vaccine may be on the order of 85% based on some limited data, but I don't think we have a lot of confidence in that. But It appears that it's very effective. We would expect it to because of the nature of what kind of virus it is, but that's our best guess.
And so very quickly, again, we have about 1 minute left, Dr. Pate. The high-risk individuals contact the health department or their doctor or
either
contact
either one. So yes. So there are people at the public health department you can talk to, and they can assess if you do in fact fall in one of these high risk groups, and they can arrange to get the vaccine for you, or you can go to your doctor. It is kind of a hassle for doctors to get a hold of this vaccine because of its status. But so you may want to go through the public health, but you look at wherever you live. What is your public health district? Probably most of the listeners here, it's going to be Central District Health. They have somebody who is designated to handle these inquiries and to make those assessments. So that may actually be your best step, is just go ahead and contact Central District Health. And then if they determine you are high risk, they can arrange to try to get that vaccine for you.
Well, Dr. Pate, as always, so thankful to have you on the show to talk us through all of this. Two and a half years in COVID, now monkeypox. Dr. Pate will be back next week with us to talk more. Always appreciate you, Dr. Pate.
Thank you, Gemma.